In this episode of Fictional Hangover, we discuss seductive hairbrushing, dramatic wafting, interpretive intellectual ballet dancing, and going to goth in Defy or Defend by Gail Carriger. Audiobook narrated by Emma Newman.
Hey everybody, welcome to Fictional Hangover, a podcast about young adult and new adult books, series and authors that is full of spoilers. I'm Beulah.
And I'm Ernestine.
And today we're going to discuss Defy or Defend by Gail Carriger, audiobook narrated by Emma Newman.
Are we still Beulah and Ernestine?
Apparently so. I think we've changed our names legally by Deepole now. At least the paperwork's due to come through.
I don't want to be Ernestine forever.
No, I don't particularly want to be Beulah forever. It kind of feels like it's a name that has a stereotype attached to it. Sure, go back to Claire and Amanda.
I think we should be Claire and Amanda again. Oh, whatever.
It's either that or we stick to our code names, our steampunk Parasolverse
yes.
code names.
Painted eyebrow.
Steaming hot cuppa.
Ooh. Standard disclaimer. If you haven't read this book, please remember that Fictional Hangover is all about spoilers. If you haven't read or listened and don't want to be spoiled, stop listening to us and go read or listen to the book. Then come back. If you haven't done this but want to pretend that you have, or if you don't care about spoilers, or if you just like the show so much that you don't care about any of that, then listen up.
Excellent. Do we have any background info for this week?
No, because oh my gosh. We have a bonus episode this week, and this is fantastic.
I'm still giddy. Yes. Like.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Guys, the bonus episode made Claire cry. Really, it really did. I don't think we have that part recorded. Tears. I saw them. It was real.
It happened last time Miss Gale was on as well.
Not like this.
No, this was totally different.
Not like this.
Gosh, oh, I get emotions.
Yes. Yes, you do. I think that's the first time I've ever actually seriously witnessed them. It was intense.
I think so. Yeah, because during the first time interview back in January, my video cut out.
You were weepy in that one for a different reason. Were sad.
Yeah. No, this is tears of joy and excitement and happiness, and that's all I'm going to say.
Yeah. So everyone, go and listen to the bonus episode. It's not quite like our normal bonus episodes. We do play Would You Rather with Miss Gale based on this book, but nothing else that we talked about really had to do with this book. So it's
all-encompassing conversation about stuff. It was just like a chat amongst friends.
And it was really great.
It was lovely.
Yeah. So go and listen to that. You can learn some neat things. Neat things that you would typically learn in the background info.
And I'm just going to brag that I've met Emma Newman, who is the audiobook narrator for this book as well, at a sci-fi convention quite a few years ago, but I did meet her and she signed my books and they are somewhere on the bookshelf, and she is lovely and has absolutely to perfection steampunk Victorian style of sense of dress. She's a wonderful, wonderful lady as well. So
that's
check out
magical.
Her books too.
That's magical.
She's lovely. Anywho. I'm going to crack on because I'm very excited to talk about Defy or Defend.
Yes,
because
it's
anything to do with Miss Gale and I want to talk about it.
Because we love Miss Gale. I was so excited for this one. I'm a little bit more than Poison or Protect, I think, because I like Dimity more than
more
I liked
attachment
Prussia.
You have more of an attachment to Dimity because she's in more of the finishing school. Prussia is very much a background hovering character. Dimity is front and centre.
Yes, and she was one of my favorites, and so I was really excited to see her as a grown-up, see what she would do.
I was excited to see if she had grown up.
She has, some.
She has. But you can imagine she has this kind of like, I say childlike effervescence.
Yes. Yeah. I feel like she does.
She's almost like a Peter Pan of finishing school, where she is an adult, except in an adult body and very, very female.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, after reading Poison or Protect, I was like, is Dimity's story going to be like this?
Oh,
I can't imagine that.
Is it going to be because... a sexual steampunk sexcapade?
Exactly. Like, pressure I expected.
Yeah.
You know? But I was
I don't
thinking,
think I can
Dimity.
Handle that from Dimity.
No, I didn't want, you know, cravats tied to a bedpost or things of that ilk from Dimity, because I just, like I say, she's got such a youthful spirit. If she did do anything like that, it would feel really wrong.
Yeah, it would be wrong. It would be. It would definitely be wrong. And I really enjoy that one of the most sexual steampunk sexcapade things that happens in this one is hairbrushing.
Oh my. Hairbrushing.
Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. It's.
Anyway.
Anyway.
Let's start.
Let's dive in, yeah.
It's March 1869, nearly 20 years after the events that took place at Mademoiselle Geraldine's finishing academy for young ladies of quality, and just prior to the introduction of the bustle.
Do the bustle. Do, 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 do. No, no, it's the hustle.
Yeah, it's not the same thing. Could you do the hustle wearing a bustle?
You'd give it a go. The bustle hustle.
I would do the bustle hustle. The hustle bustle? Wait, which way? Hustle bustle, bustle hustle.
Bustle hustle, hustle bustle. Both?
All.
You would hustle with the bustle, but do the bustle hustle?
Yes. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right, that's an important discussion.
It is.
Let's move on.
Sir Crispin Bontwy has been summoned to Bertie Luckinbill's house in a matter for the War Office. Chris is used to the eccentricities of the house, the housekeeper, and the owner, and after some pleasantries about the recent passing of his father and the funeral, they get down to business. Pleasantries? Should we say pleasantries?
Yeah, pleasantries feels the wrong kind of word to say about a funeral, but let's caveat this. Chris's father was an absolute rat bastard abuser.
Garbage person.
Who shall be whist, exactly. He will be missed by no one, most especially Chris and his many, many, many sisters. The guy was a dick.
Yep.
Better off dead.
Yeah. Okay, so back to the reason for being there. Bertie has a mission for Chris. It's Sparkles, or as the War Office have labeled her, the Honeybee. One of the greatest agents on retainer at the War Office, the Honeybee can lull people into thinking she is helpless and sweet, but she has an unflappable demeanor and is extremely capable. We know her as Dimity Plumley Tainmont. Chris is to act as her safety on a mission for Burr, the Bureau of Unnatural Registry, who has recently received word of trouble at a vampire hive in Nottingham. They seem... off. The queen communicates solely through the means of homemade Valentine cards. Most of the drones have been lost to abandonment, and there are no clear reports of vampires. The Honeybee will have to make everything shiny again.
Meanwhile, the Honeybee is trying to charm a gentleman inventor into submission, and he isn't cooperating. It's difficult to flirt with someone who won't flirt back due to paralytic shyness. Honestly, I mean, come on. And to top it off, the only subject to get the blasted man to talk is breakfast foods.
I could talk about breakfast.
Oh, I could talk about breakfast till the cows come home, but it isn't flirty material.
It would be
and
difficult
the guy
to make it
flirty. Is adult, exactly. You know, sausages and adultery just don't go together.
But sausages could be sexy. If you say them the right way.
I suppose so. It depends on how you eat them as well. And, you know, but there's nothing sexy about a grilled tomato.
No, but what if you say it like this? What if you say it with this voice?
Sexy steampunk sausages.
Sexy steampunk tomatoes.
Ooh.
yes.
With a scramble
my eggs.
Oh, with a side of bacon.
Oh, no, my God. I just thought of something terrible. There's this music group that I really like, and they have a song about eggs. How do you like your eggs? Fried or fertilized? So that's very sexy. Not really.
It's really not. It's really not. Right, let's get back to this.
Please.
Accidental traitor, shall we?
Yes.
So, the spy business is getting rather tiresome. Something Dimity has thought on more than one occasion lately. She heads to... I love this name. Lotta Piggle Tea Shop. I mean, well, Lotta Piggle Tea Shop is the greatest tea shop name of all time. Mm-hmm. With her safety on this mission, Lord Pritchard. For post-mission refreshments, and she manages to also con some new gloves from the besotted fellow. I mean, come on. He knows that she is the honeybee. He knows how she operates, and she is still able to con him. I mean, Dimity knows her works.
That's skill.
So, really, it's up. He's an idiot. Now, Sir Crispin wouldn't be so easily manipulated, though she certainly wishes she could manipulate him. Hey, wink, wink.
Sir Crispin, at the moment, is still in Bertie's home, and Lord Akeldama has joined them and is fawning over him in a way that Dama does when a delicious male specimen is before him. Especially now he knows that Chris's hair curls when it gets long, and that he has quick, deadly reflexes. Now down to business. Bertie informs Dama of Baroness Ermandy's hive situation. Dama is surprised that she is going to Goth.
I love this term, I love it.
No.
It's one of the greatest terms I've ever heard.
So good. She doesn't appear, luckily, to be in the black velvet stage yet. The queen is sequestered in a limestone cave. They lost Lord Rushwallop the previous year through an exploding wickerwork incident. The wicker chicken strikes again.
Possibly.
And they are down to 3 vampires, 1 drone, and no servants. This is a dire situation here. Baroness Ermandy is still young, so the situation seems odd for her to be taking the velvet path of colorless doom quite so soon. The course of action is decided. The honeybee will pretend to be an artist, with Chris in some other artistically creative pursuit, pretending to be her husband. They shall visit, set the hive to rights, and all will be well. If not, Burr will carry out more permanent measures with a sundowner. All in 2 weeks! And they're leaving the next day. Topping.
Oh, going to Goth, the velvet path. Oh, it's just
so amazing. Great.
Dimity is not unhappy with the situation and is practically bouncing and waxing poetic about it. She is excited to be Mrs. Careful. Her husband is such a strapping man, and she would wipe his brow with a cool cloth to ease the floating sickness as they take a dirigible to Nottingham. If Mr. Careful, her husband, would countenance it. On the float, they talk tactics in a private dining room. The youngest vampire, Mr. Wignall, is of the Dharma persuasion, so no good there. Mm. Lord Kirby and Lord Finbar would make good seduction targets, both being old-fashioned, the latter being the Hive Praetoriani, and who the War Office correspond with in Mrs. Careful's name. The drone is off-limits, and he is high-risk. Dimity will prefer the redecoration household management approach first, but policy dictates seduction first, as it is usually more effective, and they do have a narrow window to get this mission done. How terrible is it to me, to you, to anyone, that seduction is tactic number one?
Yeah, that's terrible. That's terrible.
Anything.
Especially for Dimity.
Yeah.
Anyway. With Dimity's cover being an indifferent watercolorist, we must turn our curiosity to Chris's, which turns out to be dance. Not your typical ballroom dance, by the way, but ballet, complete with pointy feet, twirling, and the occasional pirouette. It's going to movie's so good. Dimity herself has brought pretty much her whole wardrobe and accessories for days, all of which are deadly. And this new thing called a bustle, which the French fashion papers would have you believe are the latest thing. They arrive at Nottingham a few hours after sunset and are greeted by Lord Finbar. This is an indication of how bad the situation at the Hive has gotten, sending a hive-bound vampire to do a servant's job. Lord Fin, it's awful. Lord Finbar lays the Byronic melancholy rather thickly, bemoaning the grave situation of the Hive. His cravat is old lace, gone cream-colored with age. Everything seems to droop, and to top it off, he's a poet. Still, it's a well-known fact that vampires sacrifice their creativity for the bite.
You know you're going to end up hearing some of his poetry at this point.
You know it's going to happen. You know it's going to happen.
So they finally arrive at Budgie Hall, which is located in the centre of Nottingham, next to an extremely decrepit church and overlooking the church courtyard. Of course it is. It's awfully gothic. This is beyond beautiful. I love this.
It's the perfect setting.
Lord Finbar disappears, leaving them to deal with the luggage again, and not know if they should knock or not. I mean, what does one do in this situation? So they do knock, and another vampire, this one Lord Kirby, opens the door, allowing them entry. They also meet Mr. Therese, the drone who is not subtle in his resentment. The dude's a slime ball.
He's the worst. He's the literal worst.
If we're going to be overly theatrical, because let's face it, this entire book is, every time his name is mentioned, I may boo.
I think that's okay. Boo and or hiss.
Yeah. If I had some Rotten Tomatoes and his face in front of me, I would throw them. Anywho.
Yeah.
So, Dimity and Chris's room, it's glacial cold. It's dusty. And it is severely out of fashion.
Oh, no.
The entire place is practically a mausoleum. And something out of a gothic novel.
Oh.
Dimity's got a work cut out for her.
Yes. Yes, she does. Dimity pulls out a harmonic auditory resonance disruptor from her bag, which will allow them to talk freely, even with supernatural snooping. After eating a particularly gross supper, it is time for bed. And this could be awkward, but thankfully an attached dressing room preserves dignity. Chris finally sees Dimity's hair down, which has been one of his fascinations for as long as he has known her, and he is entranced. Giving in to his need to touch it, he brushes her hair, and things take a turn for the seductive. But no seduction takes place. They do finally share a bed. They are pretending to be married after all. But they do nothing but sleep. Even with the seductive hair brushing.
It kind of goes a little bit like, you know, Sunday evening Vaseline-covered Hallmark special at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Vaseline over the camera lens. Yeah. It's kind of like soft, shiny, instrumental hazy music kicks in. Yeah. It's so weird.
It's dreamy. It's dreamy.
Yes. So the next evening, they see Mr. Therese escorting a buxom shepherdess type down the hallway. What's going on here? Apparently, she is the Queen's dinner. Mr. Therese is curt and sharp with Dimity after he has finished escorting the young woman out. Why is he still here? He is a dreadful man.
He's just awful.
He is awful. It is over dinner, the strangest they have ever had, an all-in-one affair with no pudding course.
Ugh.
No pudding course, Amanda.
It's dreadful.
Disgraceful.
It's dreadful.
That they finally meet Hive member Mr. Wignall, or Justice, who can only be described as the potential heroine of a gothic novel.
I love Justice.
Justice is the best. I adore Justice. Justice is still sporting the velvet of the Hive, but wore a white billowing shirt akin to the overly dramatic pirate. Once the meal is consumed, the vampires leave to hunt. To hunt, Amanda!
This is terrible!
What is going
on? What are they doing?
Oh my gosh! This must be reported to Burr, and it must be reported immediately. And then Lord Finbar asks for the Queen's chambers to be checked as a neighbour has gone missing.
Oh, what? No. What? Oh, it's terrible. Everything about this is awful. I don't think Dimity's going to be able to fix it. What? What can be done?
A shopping trip.
Ah, yes. Perfect. Priority number one is to find a tea house. They haven't been served any tea since arriving at Budgie Hall.
I'm offended on their behalf.
I am too, and I don't even have tea. And I am offended. Plus, this will give them the opportunity to plan and discuss their next steps. Chris and Dimity agree not to inform Burr, and their best plan is to lure the Queen back into society. A little redecorating, a little meddling, just enough to bring out the curiosity in her. Fun mission to go out on. Wait, what did Sparkles just say? A mission to go out on? What?
Vampires are notoriously nocturnal, so meddling during the daylight hours means no interference. Excellent. First things first, hot cross buns from the local bakery, and on the way back to recruit domestic staff, parlour maids, three of them. Other positions would take longer to fill, so they'll come in time. But in no time at all, dusting, sweeping, beating carpets and curtains being measured and ordered happens. Dimity has made a list, and on top of her list of jobs to be done, things to be ordered and staff to be hired. Eventually, the activity wakes the odious Mr. Therese. No! Calling the activity chaos, he is not happy and will deal with them all after dark when Lord Finbar is awake. Obviously, Mr. Therese thinks of the hive as his domain. What an odious man.
Lord Finbar isn't put out by the cleaning and meddling. More its effects on his ennui. Dimity argues that no dust means no sneezing, which helps maintain melancholy to no end. You can't be melancholy and sneeze at the same time.
You really can't.
No.
You really can't. This is a known fact.
In Dimity's useful style, she has the vampire befuddled and convinced that everything from the decoration to the new color scheme was his idea. Well done, Dimity. Lord Kirby doesn't seem that bothered, and frankly, Justice, who apparently has a human lover, takes advantage of the clean banisters to throw dramatic poses and waft about wistfully.
Oh, Justice.
I love Justice so much. Oh, yes. So, it's a day well done, and now it's off to bed for Mr. and Mrs. Careful.
So, apart from Chris sniffing Dimity's hair, I mean... And Dimity snuggling up to him for warmth, nothing of a steampunk sexcapade happens yet.
Yet.
But Dimity has decided to seduce him. Well done, yes. Dimity. Espionage had never been her chosen goal in life. Darn her natural talents that were honed at the school. She wants a home. She wants a husband. And she wants children. Meanwhile, the cleaning and redecoration is coming on apace, with a veritable army of tradesfolk ready to get to work. While Dimity makes some terrible paintings of cows or dogs or whatever the heck she claims them to be, honestly.
I want this painting.
I do. I want somebody to do the fan art for this. I feel like it's going to be me.
With your wrong hand, too.
Oh,
please.
God, yes. Oh, God, yes. So Chris decides to get into the character of Mr. Careful, donning an indecently tight dancing attire, returning to an adjoining room to Dimity, where he shall stretch and frolic like the cow in her picture. Dimity has gone a little red-faced and a little breathless at this, which is understandable. Male ballet outfit. Dancers are freaking hugely buff. I mean...
Yeah. Whew. Yeah.
But in walks Mr. Therese. He finds him in the artistic pursuit and is a bit of a put out by it, frankly. Justice finds it delightful. The former dancer himself and his lover has a similar glorious physique to Mr. Careful. It wasn't until Justice drifted away that Chris realised he was wearing Dimity's nightdress. Donning his greatcoat, Chris follows him into the night.
I love justice so much.
This entire... I just want more justice.
Yes.
If there was justice in the world, there would be more justice.
Dimity introduces Lord Finbar to Rosie, one of the parlor maids, who would make an excellent drone. Rosie is very taken with him being a vampire and a poet, and having someone to adore his poetry would be good for him. When a milkmaid-looking lass knocks at the door as the queen's meal, Dimity tries to follow Mr. Theris as he takes her down, but isn't successful. Drat. Dimity also executes another turnabout with Lord Kirby. Honestly, she's like the best at confusing things in a way that makes someone think they're responsible for every great thing that she's done ever. And it's fantastic. She finds out Mr. Theris is the reason why all the servants and drones have left. He basically ran them off, called some lazy, accused others of stealing, etc., etc., etc. He's a garbage person. As if on cue, the previous cook knocks on the door, asks for her old contract back, so long as Mr. Theris stays out of her way. Agreed! Mr. Theris is spitting teeth. It's great. It's so great.
As Dimity was performing mild domestic miracles and befuddlement, Chris followed justice and deduced that the vampire is an absolute loon. In a very dramatic fashion, he has run through the forest to have a lover's liaison, where Justice and his lover, Mr. Gantry, have an encounter fit for the stage. Gantry is desperate to be Justice's drawn so that they can be together. But that is a decision for the Hive Queen, who Justice sees nothing of. Oh, the lament. Oh, the tragedy. Oh, my despair. Goodness, this is too much. This grand awful. Passion. I must faint onto this couch now. Hand to forehead.
Oh, your décolletage.
Oh, my décolletage. Available
at
redbubble.com/fictionalhangover.
No, it's your way. fictionalhangover.redbubble.com for your décolletage needs. Dimity is on the hunt for the queen. She hears her, but doesn't find her. Mr. Theris does. Garbage person, slimeball. And he calls her out for snooping. Once in the foyer, Mr. Theris tries to turn on the charm and twiddles with the Dimity's buttons and propositions her. Luckily, Chris returns, none too pleased. Yay. He could see that Dimity had the situation semi under control with her pistol drawn, as having the gun drawn means she isn't working an angle. Mr. Theris leaves now that his target is no longer alone, but he leaves without the key to the queen's cave. Once in their room with the auditory resonance disruptor on, they share information, including that the queen's withdrawal appears to be fashion-based. Gasp. A few other pieces of information are exchanged, and finally, they kiss! Oh! Swoon!
That's a good time. Later that evening, Dimity and Chris do get up to more, but we are ladies and respect their privacy and shall not go into detail, only to say Chris does promise full ravishment when they are no longer living in a hive on a mission.
No!
Dimity has her Tuppenny Night at last. Chris has turned into her errand boy. Her lists are extensive, as you can imagine, but it is necessary if they are to succeed. It also seems to have become a ritual for everyone to gather at midnight for tea, vampires, staff and the tradespeople. Lord Finbar enjoys the company of Rosie, Lord Kirby, the discussions with the tradesfolk, and Justice engages with Dimity about fashion. At the gathering, Dimity gives Lord Kirby a gift of an automated chamois, which, to his delight, the gadget spurs lively conversation, and Lord Kirby starts carrying it around like a pet. I mean, it's a chamois, it's a cleaning device, come on. Dimity, I mean, he has a little holster for her, bless him. Anyways, Dimity really knows what she is doing, so she requires a corgi for the hive.
As you do.
As you do. She also helps Justice overcome his self-consciousness and wear a exquisite blue deer dress and start sending fashion papers and material samples to the Queen via the shepherdesses. One, called Betsy, requests another visit with the Queen as she seemed so sad. According to Mr. Therese, the Queen does not like repeat meals, but she is so sincere, Dimity sneaks her down. And it works a treat. Betsy is to be given a room in the hall. Mr. Therese had proved to be the biggest problem, so Chris makes some remarks about the stage in London and suggesting he consider his career first. Thankfully, he takes the bait, and the orgious man is to go away.
Oh my gosh. Yes. Justice has bloomed with Dimity, and most especially Chris's support. She has taken on the feminine pronouns and simply adores fashion. Chris dances with her, compliments her, and gives brotherly advice about not being taken advantage of by men. Dimity, meanwhile, is working on Gantry, or rather his parents, and getting them to accept this relationship. The issue is that they are intellectuals. The grand passion the two have quite confuses them. So, the first step is formally inviting him for tea, and soon, Gantry is a regular visitor and very comfortable in the household. If only they could make it permanent. Lord Finbar, on the other hand, has been considering enlarging and opening the library to the public. This is very progressive and a good sign of stability. I want to go to that library.
So do I. And because Lord Finbar's a vampire, he'll be still there as head librarian.
Yeah.
With his melancholy.
Yes. And his ennui.
Every Thursday night will be poetry night.
Oh, it probably would be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll go on a Wednesday. Okay. Dimity is going behind Chris's back and taking Betsy for trysts with the Baroness. This is good progress, as Betsy does not always come out with puncture wounds. Love marks, yes, but not puncture wounds, so the Queen is only feeding when necessary. Lord Finbar's library is coming along apace as well, with Lord Kirby's carpenter friend regularly at the hall. Lord Finbar even wants to hold an intellectual salon, that Dimity suggested. Or was it his idea?
I think it was his idea. Pretty sure it was his idea.
Yeah, it was his idea. Additionally, Lord Finbar has composed a new somber and melancholic piece. Dear listener, we shall not overwhelm you by its profound nature. It is simply too powerful, too moving for our podcast. Alas, the smooth sailing must come an end. With the reappearance of Mr. Ferris. He walks through the front door with none other than Lord Macon, Alpha of the Wolsey Pack, Head of Burr, and Sundowner. Lord Macon is checking on the situation and to remind them of the time-sensitive nature of their mission. Mr. Ferris found no luck in London with his acting, to no one's surprise. Dharma doesn't find him suitable as a drawn, shock, horror, and would rather he went to the wolves. I suspected more as a meal than a clavenger, but you know.
Yeah.
He is also not happy that Dimity has been seeing to the welfare of the Queen with great success. Chris isn't either, but we'll come back to that one. In a traditional bad guy form, he threatens Chris, but honestly, he's not really threatening, is he? I mean,
no, he's just a twat.
Yeah.
The next night, Mr. Therese is beastly. He upsets Rosie, ridicules Lord Finbar's expansion of the library and establishing it as a lending library, flirts outrageously with the carpenter in front of Lord Kirby. He is a shitbag. Even Trudge the Corgi is despondent around him. Only Betsy seems to take on Mr. Therese with righteous indignation. Good for her. Dimity also asks Lord Finbar if he would rather the Praetoriani duties go to Lord Kirby because he doesn't want to overtax himself and impact his melancholy. And Lord Kirby is very willing. Thankfully, he agrees to swap roles. They just need to get the queen to emerge and agree to it.
So, let's go back to Chris not being pleased that Dimity has been attending the High Queen alone. Chris is her safety and she's gone against protocol. And Dimity obviously knows she is doing something wrong because she never said anything. This is putting some strain on their relationship. But given what they are getting up to in the bedroom... I really don't think so.
Sexual steampunk sexcapades?
Yes, darling. There's so much hairbrushing.
Oh, sensual hairbrushing.
Oh, yes. 100 strokes, don't you know?
Oh. I can't. 100 strokes did me in. It is the night of the intellectual salon. Dimity's brother, Pillover.
Yay!
Now an Pillover. Oxford Don is in attendance. Yay, Pillover! I love Pillover so much. Dimity introduces him to Lord Finbar, and as they are both impossibly glum and dour, they shall get along smashingly. During the evening, Pillover tracks Chris down and has an unconventional brotherly conversation with him, which ends in him pretty much begging Chris not to let him put him off marrying his sister. So good. He's had to put up with hearing about Chris at length for years. And frankly, he can't take it anymore. Oh, good old Pillover. Lord Macan is also in attendance, but keeping out of the way. The hope is that a good enough show will prevent him needing to take any sundowner action. Justice is wearing a pink frilly concoction, and her interactions with Gantry are restrained. And his parents are confused, shocked, and delighted. The only potential hiccup is the loud screaming coming from the Queen's cave. She has yet to be fed. This is, of course, by design. Dimity knows what she is doing and is hopeful that curiosity will entice the queen out of her cave.
So Dimity trots down to the cave with a special present and is careful to introduce herself to the queen. Talking fashion seems to calm the queen. She's appreciative of the gifts of fashion papers and cloth samples. Finally, we are able to find out what the heck happened. I have been curious this entire time.
Yes.
Countess Nadastay has a very different stature to the Baroness and would continually influence fashion in a direction that did not suit her. To remind you, gentle readers, Countess Nadastay is the Hive Queen in London.
Yes.
So she is in prime influential circles.
Yes.
Her favourite drone also left to have her career on the operatic stage. And finding Nottingham far too provincial to be able to do it there. And then her dear Lord Rashwallop went a little mad and killed a few people before being taken out by a sundowner. The final straw came when a drone asked for the bite and died attempting metamorphosis. Oh. In shame and sadness, she took to her cave. But now the bustle has been introduced.
Mm.
Oh, this complements the Baroness's figure while ill-suiting the Countess's.
Yes.
And she has her Betsy. But Dimity informs her that Betsy has gone missing, which finally brings the Queen out. She has missed her dear vampire so, and the bustle has given her the confidence to emerge.
Betsy has been locked in the silver cabinet, a room only Mr. Theris had access to. The odious man was being seduced by a werewolf Clavager, so he didn't care about their opinion of him. He'd had enough and was going to the Sheffield pack. Finally, we all celebrate.
Yes.
Oh. The Queen held court over the intellectual salon with Lord Macan watching on. Gantry is presented and accepted by the Queen, and he is soon to be an official drone. As will Rosie. Trudge the Corgi is, of course, the true winner, easily charming the queen into submission.
Good doggo.
It's a good doggo. The intellectuals at the salon. I have to say it that way every time. I can't say salon. It doesn't work in American English.
No, I'm glad that you're saying it that way. I appreciate it. Thank you.
The intellectuals at the salon are enthralled by the dramatics and trying to infer meaning into it all, especially the throwing away of blank Valentine's cards.
Bravo! Oh,
fantastic. But what of Dimity and Chris? Well, the honeybee married her tuppenny knight. They produced an embarrassing amount of offspring in rapid succession and spent many nights running down garden paths, dressing gowns trailing behind, and laughing. An excellent ending.
Just level in everywhere.
It is so good.
Do you know what? I found this is just completely opposite to Precious Story.
It is. It really, really is. But that's good because they're two completely different people. If it had been in any way similar, it wouldn't feel right. It wouldn't feel real.
No. And it perfectly suited Dimity. It was just the grand dramatics of it all. And it shows you what kind of intelligence that Dimity's turned into. And you obviously saw the growth of that in the Finishing School series. But she's an influencer.
Mm-hmm.
And a manipulator.
Yeah.
And yes, is you know, the same policy number one, seduction. And yes, she can seduce people, but she isn't it doesn't go all the way.
No.
She never crosses that line, except with Chris. And then it's very voluntarily.
Yes. Yeah, that was fine.
And it's about bloody time. But yes, I really enjoyed it. It was such a good laugh. There was just so many characters. And as I was reading it, I kept thinking, I need to see this character as cosplay. I need to see that character as a cosplay. Like, whereas with Poison or Protect, I felt it was very limited. Like, it was more insular. It was mainly just Gavin and Pressure. While with this one, it was a whole cast of characters. Mm-hmm. It was like a theatrical stage show. It was done so well and so differently. It was, tonally, it was like it could have been one of those awfully dramatic plays on the, like, where Poison or Protect wasn't. And it was delightful.
Yeah.
Deeply deadly, you might say.
Yeah, this one was... Oh, indeed. This one was a little more suited to my taste.
Yeah.
Because, as we all know, I really, really enjoy Finishing School and, like, the silliness of that one. And while I do love the original Parasol Protectorate and, you know, the other short stories and other things that go along with that, and, of course, the Custard Protocol, like, just the, I guess, the young adultness of Finishing School is what I really, really enjoy about it. And so this, it leans into that really heavily. It's not, there's not any sexual steampunk sexcapades in this one. And that's, as we talked about last time, not my favorite thing.
No. I think.
So I really enjoyed this one.
I think this one's definitely a true offspring of the Finishing School. Poison or Protect for me could have actually gone further. It could have gone a lot further into more of an adult book. It was treading a fine line of trying to be a sequel to a YA series and keep those fans involved, while as trying to make the protagonist more of an adult. I think it could have been pushed further, and it would have been... I would have enjoyed it more for it being pushed into a true adult novel. But this one is definitely...
I feel like it pairs more... I feel like Poison or Protect pairs more with Custard Protocol, because it also... There's a lot of stuff, especially in Reticence, that ties this one together, or ties in with it. You know, you meet Arsenic, and you see that this is Precious' daughter, and so you learn a little bit about Precious and Gavin through Arsenic. So those two are kind of tied together a little bit more.
Definitely, because after Poison or Protect, I went back and read Reticence. I didn't go back to read the Finishing Schools. I went back to read Reticence because I needed to make that comparison. Whereas after reading Defy or Defend, I want to go back and read the Finishing School series.
There
is some, yes, it is. This is definitely the true child of the Finishing School. It's more within that realm. But you know, this isn't to put the Poison or Protect it down. It's just this one was more suited for YA, even though Dimity is quite clearly an adult.
Mm-hmm. Quite clearly having her hair sexually hairbrushed.
Yes, quite clearly has adult thoughts and happenings and admires Chris as an adult.
In his striped bathing costume.
Oh my god, yes. But it's still got that delight about it that is the Finishing School series. And it's still very much got Dimity in the essence. And all of the cast of characters around it are just fully... it's just delightful.
There's more whimsy.
Yes.
And wafting in the show.
I have never read a book with more wafting. This is quite clearly so the most wafting of books.
Yes.
Oh, justice.
Yes.
Everything justice.
Yes.
Yeah, it was just brilliant. Justice. It was so good. And just the amount of melancholy and ennui. I love the word ennui. It's like quinoa. You see it written down, you go, what?
What is that?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, ennui. Ennui. Do you know what I love that we didn't talk too terribly much about in the summary?
What?
Crispin's ballet dancing. Especially his ballet dancing to the intellectual presentation at the end of the story.
It's awkward and brilliant. And how does one do an intellectual presentation?
It's in interpretive ballet dance. How do you interpretive dance to an intellectual presentation? How do you do it?
Exactly. Considering by the end of the intellectual salon, it was the Baroness just throwing away her Valentine's card, saying yes to everybody's requests and all the changes and drawn in inclusions, and yes to this and yes to that, and isn't everything wonderful? Look at my bustle. It's just the way that all the guests who didn't know what the hell was happening were trying to interpret this and the meaning behind it as if it was some kind of production.
It was as if it were all purposefully done.
Yes.
And, you know, like having intellectual conversations about the ballet dancing to the intellectual presentations. And it's like, oh yes, this is perfectly reasonable and everything makes perfect sense. I understand everything completely. Like, no.
What does the throwing of the Valentine's cards really mean? Honestly, crazy. Absolutely crazy. I do feel like corresponding now in badly homemade Valentine's cards. And it's the fact that the entirety of the Hive seems to forgotten. They've given up their creativity when they took the bite. It's like, no, I can still write poetry. No, I can still create Valentine's cards. No, you can't. You really can't. Oh, that poem. No. Oh, my God.
No, all of that's gone.
No. But yet Rosie's it's so bad. Yes, it's so poetry. it's just dreadful. It's just dreadful.
Oh, Rosie. Yes. Oh, man. You know, I also really enjoyed the hints and sprinkles of Robin Hood stuff happening because this is set in Nottingham.
Yeah.
And there was so much little like Robin Hood stuff sprinkled in the beginning. The werewolf packs stealing from the rich and giving to the poor.
Oh, weren't they the ones that used to wear feathers and caps?
Robin Hood.
Yeah.
Yes. And indecently tight trousers or something along those lines.
Men in tights. Let's just say it.
Men in tights, indeed.
Indeed. I liked as well the hints at the Wicked Chicken. So you know how Lord Rushwallop had a wicker accident? I was like, it's the Wicked Chicken. It's Sophronia. It's got to be.
The Wicked Chicken.
Why is she doing this? But then when the Baroness was like, oh, and he just killed a few people. It's like, ah, that's why. There you go. So, does this mean Sophronia is a Sundowner?
Yeah.
Do you think Sophronia is a Sundowner?
I fully expect her to be a Sundowner. Yeah. Unless she's, like, too far underground and no one knows that she...
If it was anybody, buddy.
Yeah. But if anyone could be a Sundowner, it would be Sophronia.
Well, to be fair, she's, like, the only
Unless she just stole a Sundowner gun.
Well, I wouldn't put that past her. But considering who her patron is, because she's, like, the only one who's left Madame Geraldine's, and it's not being patronised by Lord Akeldama. So...
Yeah. She could have been, though.
She wasn't, though. She promised her services.
No, but she could have been. She chose.
She could. Oh, yeah. Yeah. She had the pick.
Because
but
of
soap. Exactly.
Oh,
she chose
soap.
But yes. I wouldn't put it past that she hasn't been given Sundowner status. I definitely mm-hmm. think she's been given Sundowner status. So could have been, you know, if it wasn't Lord McCorn, it could have been Sophronia who turned up to at the end. It would have been too much, though, to have Sophronia there.
Yeah, I feel like she's probably doing putting more wars. Important stuff.
Saving people and putting wars.
Putting wars.
Yeah.
Yes.
Taking down some mad tyrants.
Yes. Overthrowing masterminds.
Yeah.
And secret societies.
Probably.
She's doing all of those things.
All at once, probably.
Yeah.
Do you know what I love?
Yes. Probably.
Do you know what I loved?
What?
How Chris basically turned into Justice's big brother. Even though Justice
is that was sweet.
50 years Chris's senior. But it was just lovely. It was just lovely. And we didn't cover it in the summary, but Chris had a brother who was very much like Justice. And his sisters would dress him up in all of their frippery, and he absolutely adored it. And he was, and I love the phrase, the Dharma persuasion.
Yes.
And so identified the same as Justice, was just in the wrong body, I suppose. And Chris totally accepted it. And unfortunately, his brother, Tristan, killed himself. He hung himself. And that's obviously left a massive hole with Chris. And when he's seen Justice, it's kind of like, I found him again.
Yeah.
And I don't want that badness to happen to him.
Yeah.
But this is again why Chris's father is a rat bastard abuser who none shall mourn him. Because he was the one who basically drove his own son to kill himself. So, you know, world's better fun for him not being in it. But I just adored it. The way he was like, you look gorgeous today, Justice. Oh, aren't you wonderful? Come dance with me. And it's just, honestly, just took him under the took her under the wing and just helped Justice be herself. It was lovely.
Yeah, it was.
And also the fact that Justice would go out into the forest wearing Dimity's night rail and have grand liaisons in her grand passion with Gendry. It just it just reeks of the lurid gothic novel, and I am there for it.
Yes, I can just see Justice like swooning and like resting elegantly over like a large stone with her skirts trailing behind her and like
perfectly.
Chiffon blowing in the wind. I can
exactly.
see it.
Perfectly
I can see it all happening.
Out.
Yes.
Just as the moonlight, the perfect beam of moonlight.
Yes. Yes.
Justice would be a Disney princess.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think so.
Definitely.
Is there a vampire Disney story? Because Justice could be.
There needs to be one.
Do you know, I really liked, there does, I really liked, there like they had a brief moment of thinking that they could pass Justice off as the Hive Queen.
Yes.
If, like, if they needed to. And that would have been so perfect. Justice being a Hive Queen. It would have been so great. They could have got her like a little extra set of fangs to stick in. You know, they're fake because he doesn't have the maker fangs. Oh, I'm sorry, because she doesn't have maker fangs. But It would be great.
Exactly. It would have been beautiful.
Justice could be. Yes, justice could be. Hive Queen.
I want justice to be a Hive Queen.
Surrogate Hive Queen.
Yes, I do want justice to be a Hive Queen.
Could you imagine all the heads that would turn because Hive Queens can't leave the hive, but Justice can, and it would be like, oh, so shocking. Look at this beautiful Hive Queen. On? She's left the hive. What is happening?
Is she swarming? What's going on?
It would be so great.
It would be confusing. It would be so great. Anything. It was brilliant. But it was like Gentry's parents when they came to the intellectual salon, and then Justice comes down in this frilly pink dress and throws herself dramatically into Gentry's arms. And Gentry's like, oh, my love, oh, my sweet, oh, my darling. And they're like, it's a girl?
Yeah. And they're like, we were certain it wouldn't be. We were certain it wouldn't be a girl. But
they were convinced. It's like, well.
Yes.
It's a transition. I'm glad Gentry got drawn status as well.
Yeah. It's very nice. Very nice.
It was all neatly tied off. It was lovely.
We talked about quite a bit of things that we like. I feel like there's only one thing. There's only one thing that we don't like.
Well, you know, I don't know if we were very... I think we're too subtle. I don't think our wonderful listeners will have picked up on the one thing we didn't like. And it's the one thing you're not supposed to like.
Right. You don't think they picked up on it? You're right. We were very subtle with our distaste.
Maybe we need to spell it out.
Ugh. Mr. Theris was the worst. Oh, when he was playing with Dimity's buttons, like, I wanted to throw up.
I wanted to throw up.
I'm just so glad she pulled a gun on him.
I wanted her to shoot. Because that man is disgusting.
Ugh. Ugh. Let's just not even talk about it anymore.
Can I fan cast him?
Sure.
Timothy Spall.
Ew. I feel like Timothy Spall is too old. Yeah, do you know who I imagine?
A younger Timothy Spall. It's got to be a younger age-appropriate Timothy Spall. But Timothy Spall can play a really creepy person, and it's got to be age-appropriate Timothy Spall, but yeah, that's who I fan-casted.
Do you know who I fan-casted? Because I actually did it this time.
Okay, who?
Josh Gad. He was LeFou in the live-action Beauty and the Beast.
Yes!
Even though LeFou in the live-action Beauty and the Beast turned out to be quite delightful at the end, he's very talented, but he just makes me cringe. But perfect.
Cringy, lecherous. Yes. Oh,
yes.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I'll change my fan cast to that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he's very fine and lovely. I'm sure.
Going by, you know, social media and stuff like that, he seems like an absolutely spot on guy. But the guy's got range. He could play the creep.
Yeah.
He could play the bunt with like very nice. Ugh.
Yes. Ugh. It takes a very talented person to make you do that.
Yeah, yeah.
To make you just go, oh, stop it, gross. Ugh.
Vomit in my mouth.
Yes. Ugh. Ugh.
No.
I don't want to talk about it anymore.
Okay. Can I say the other thing that I wish we had more of?
What?
Mrs. Bagley. Who was Bertie, the War Office guy's house... made. She was the inspiration behind the social media question, because when she opens the door, she's dressed in this costume that we don't know if it's a yellow butterfly or a moth. And then she changes her costume again halfway through, and then I'm sure she changes it for a third time. And Chris is unfazed by this, because he's friends with Bertie. He's been to the house quite a lot, so he's used to the eccentricities. But Mrs. Bagley takes absolutely no shit from Bertie. Purposefully gives Chris extra cake because it's the day of his father's funeral, so he deserves it. And then when Bertie gives her shit, she's like, you're not getting any more, and you're not going to get any tomorrow either, mate. It's like, hang on, who's the servant and who's the employer in this relationship? Because I think tables have turned somewhat.
Yes.
And honestly, Mrs. Bagley needs to be in more. She was brilliant.
Yes.
I don't know if she has been in others or we will expect her back, but I need her back. She was brilliant and not in enough for my liking.
Is she your favourite character then?
No. She's there. She is one of them. But she wasn't in it enough to be classified as like my particular favourite character. It's obviously going to be Justice. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
But
obviously,
I wanted more obviously. Mrs. Bagley. I think there's history there. I think there's a story. I got a very strong sense. Do you remember Mr. Downing, Father Downing Investigates with the nun, sister's yes. death? And every episode she would do something and you're thinking, hang on, has she been a prostitute? Has she been a drug dealer? Has she done this? Has she done that? She is a young lady, but she has a history. And I feel it's the same with Mrs. Bagley.
Do you think that Mrs. Bagley might have attended a certain academy for young ladies of quality?
Yes. I think there's a very good chance.
Yes.
Even if Bertie doesn't know that she is, I would not put it past somebody.
You know, maybe she's retired at this point.
Maybe she is, but I also wouldn't put past Dharma, the werewolf. even Queen Victoria herself, to have someone inside the War Office man's household.
Yeah.
If he's carrying out sensitive business in his own home.
Yeah, it's perfectly reasonable. What if...
Agatha.
Yep. There she is. There she is.
However, there's a very long-standing relationship in there. Mrs. Bagley's been there for a while, but who's to say Mrs. Bagley's there for a little while and then takes a month off to go to Japan and find some foxes?
I mean, that's some time later.
That's true.
This could be what she's doing right now.
That's true. But yes,
or who's to say that Mrs. Bagley is one person?
Again, that's what with the costumes and the extravagance. Yeah. No, I agree. I'm with you. I'm on that page.
Yep.
I'm writing
right,
that fanfic.
Good.
There's more.
Yes.
Throw that one in the bag.
There's more of Agatha being in every book at some point.
I'm getting to the point where Agatha is everyone.
She is. She could be. She's everywhere. She's everywhere you want to be. Oh, it's fantastic.
I think we've covered our favourite characters. If it's not obvious,
I think so. Yes.
If it's not obvious at this point, then, you know.
Yes.
What about any surprises? Did any?
Oh, I was just so pleasantly surprised when Pillover showed up because I loved Pillover in Finishing School. And he was very important and he was always there when the girls from Geraldine's and the boys from Bunsen's were able to get together. He was always there and he was fantastic.
He's always
there. And I'm so glad.
With the derogatory comment to his sister.
Yes. And his nose in a book.
His nose in a book and completely not bother with what's going on, but can do everything. He's so capable.
Yes. With all the girls swooning over him all the time.
Yes. He is the Percy of the Finishing Schools, because Percy's
he
the
is.
Same. They're both Oxford dons. They've both got irritating sisters.
Yes.
They've both got noses stuck in books.
Yes.
They both don't care about what's going on, but they do care and will sort out whatever needs to be sorted out. And they're both very capable. They are very similar. I want to know if Pillover and Percy have ever met. It's what, 20, is there a 20 year difference between Finishing School and Parasolverse and then another 20 years between Parasolverse and
I think originally in the beginning of Poisoner Protect it was 10 years, but I'm pretty sure we decided that it's a little bit greater than 10. So I would say at least 15.
So that is that there's a good chance that when Percy is an Oxford Don, Pilorvit is an Oxford Don.
Yes, there could be some crossover.
Or at the very least, Percy has been educated at Oxford while Pilorvit was a professor there.
Yes.
Depending on if Pilorvit gets his own story and what happens there.
Hopefully Pilorvit will get his own story and it is that he is a professor of Latin.
Yes.
And that is why Percy enjoys Latin so much, because it was his favorite professor. And now they're still friends and they still have correspondence.
Always in Latin.
Always in Latin.
Yes.
Yes. Okay, good.
So there's some more fanfic written.
Yes.
Or our gifts to you, Miss Gale, are all these ideas, so you don't have to come up with them. Just to make your life a little bit easier. Because honestly, you know, if we could get these stories, I don't even need a full story. I would be happy with a 6-page thing.
Yeah. I'll take it.
Yeah.
I
thought Pilorvit was the biggest surprise for me. I was just happy he turned up.
Yes.
And happy he had that conversation with Chris. It's like, please don't stop flirting with my sister. Please, please propose marriage. Just get it over with.
Please don't stop talking to my sister because of me. You guys need to get together. I'm tired of hearing about you. Just go ahead and get married, please.
Go away.
He's like, oh, okay. Will do.
Thank you for your blessing.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. So good. This episode is just amazing in every way. And do you know what?
What?
It's about to get better.
Is it time?
Because it's time. It's time. It's time for Would You Rather.
You Rather!
It's time for Would You Rather, and this time is so special because our favorite of most favorite authors is back. Miss Gale is with us again.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Hello. Welcome back.
Thank you.
There's one author that needs no introduction on this podcast.
None at all. Because how many episodes do we talk about her? At least all of them. In some passing form or another.
I mean, like I've said on many occasions, I'm not at stalker level yet, but you know, I'm not in America. So
the sea that separates us is all that keeps me safe. Is that what you're trying to say?
Basically. I would be nice about it though. I would bring tea and biscuits. I wouldn't just stop you empty-handed. There would be offerings made.
That's the important part.
Exactly. What's the point of traveling all that time? That's bringing twinings. I mean, come on.
True. I'm drinking it right now.
Same.
Oh my gosh. We should play Would You Rather. I think we should play Would You Rather. Claire, what's our first question?
The question we asked on social media, as well, we posted onto the Parasol Protector Squee group. And if you are a fan of Miss Gale's, go on there now. Is Would You Rather dress as a yellow butterfly or a moth? And this was an homage to Mrs. Bagley, who is the housekeeper to Bertie and just simply wonderful in every single way. And I need more of her. That is a fact. So on Facebook, 54% said butterfly and 46% said moth. On Instagram, 44% said butterfly and 56% said moth. And on Twitter, it was a straight up 50-50.
Ooh.
I'm very surprised. There was a lot of anti-yellow in the comments.
There was. They were all anti-yellow.
Yeah, that's me. I don't like yellow. I have tried to make my peace with yellow as something to wear over the years and never managed to do it. So it is like one of the few like block categories of colors that I went with. I have a lot of other colors that I'm not particularly into, like olive green, but I like green, right? And yellow, I'm pretty much the whole category. Like I have tried butter yellows and soft yellows and bright yellows, and no, it does not. Like I have a real yellow skin tone, and it just makes me, yellow makes me look jaundiced, doesn't matter whether it's warm or cool or whatever. So so I went with moth for this one.
I'm trying to think if I have anything yellow in my wardrobe, and I
I have lots of yellow.
Do not. You have a complexion that would suit yellow, though.
Yeah, I think I'm more blue on the inside than I am yellow. Yeah. Like, my tone is
I have
blue,
yellow flowers on the top I'm wearing and yellow honeybees. But no, I don't own anything yellow. See, but I can't go moth because I have a trauma about moths.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
What is your moth
trauma? My moth
trauma,
which to this day is still no. I was brushing my teeth and you know sometimes you get like that buildup of toothpaste, like foamy stuff at the corner of your mouth. A moth flew into the bathroom and landed on the side of my mouth as I was brushing my teeth. And it freaked me out. I had to stop, I had to clean, and I basically scrubbed my face so much it was red raw. And ever since then, and we're talking like 20 plus years of trauma from this one single moth. Even last night in bed, and I'm just reading, and a moth came in through the open window, and I'm looking at you going, you're going to die. You have to die. I'm sorry, all wildlife enthusiasts, so, you know, people who care for wildlife, but if a moth comes near me, I squish it into the weird ass powder it turns into. I hate moths. So as much as yellow doesn't suit my complexion, I will suffer it not to be a moth. And those huge giant ones in Australia.
Oh, I think they're amazing. I don't have any critter or anything, so I don't mind butterflies or moths. So it's all based on color for me.
Yeah.
I think I would be a moth just because there are more options of color. Like, this is a very specific yellow butterfly. Mm. But I would like to be in any other colors. So I don't want to be limited. I don't want to be forced to be yellow.
I'm just happy to have a cape, if I'm honest. Capes are underrated.
It is fun to waft. Yeah. I have a couple of dresses with sort of capes or flowy, you know, attachments or whatever. And like, yeah. I'm always wafting. Once you're trailing something, yeah, you're exactly. You're like, now I am tempted to just sort of flourish as I walk everywhere.
And you kind of like do this kind of, you like have ballet, to kind of whoo, where you just kind of click your feet up. You're like, oh, I'm prancing around everywhere, and everybody gives you funny looks. I don't care. I'm wafting, and I'm wafting here.
Yeah, this weekend actually was supposed to be Denver Comic Con, and I was really excited to go because I've never been to an event that was also a 4th of July weekend event. And I had all of these outfits that were like superhero but me planned, and most of them involved capes of some kind that I was going to be wearing. And that is mostly why I'm sad it's not happening.
Oh, no. Because
my outfits were so good. Hopefully I'll have an opportunity to wear them all again someday.
You should just wear them and take pictures.
You will need to catwalk them. Yeah.
Yeah, too much effort.
I need an event, goddammit.
Yeah, I know. I have to have a reason.
Not me. I'll just live every day in costume and it's fine.
You'd live every day in 6 costumes if given the opportunity.
I love wearing costumes, probably too much, but that's okay.
I know, you are such an addict.
Thank you for me being in every single cosplay thing that you have on Pinterest too. I noticed that. I was like, I'm there.
Too much. Every time
if you make it pinnable, I'll pin it. Like, that's just your sort of rule. I was like, well, you didn't hide the image, so like it gets pinned.
I don't think you'll ever. No,
I've got another good one for this week too. I think
I've seen it already. Twice. It's excellent. I'm looking forward to next week's as well.
Next week's is going to be fun. But we can't spoil it.
Oh, there's so many choices from Defy and Defend as well.
I know, it's so good. Okay.
Next question.
So next question. Would you rather be called Honeybee or Sparkles?
I think Honeybee. Mostly because Sparkles is just not really my personality at all. I don't think, even if I'm wearing like a gold dress or a silver dress or something, I don't think anyone's ever attempted to call me Sparkles or Spark. I know my personality would never be defined as sparkling in any way. So it just doesn't suit. So it has to be Honeybee by default, although I'm not particularly sweet either. But yeah, so Honeybee.
Even though you have an aversion to yellow?
Even though I have an aversion to
yellow. I feel like they're tied together.
But they are, like, I am kind of, like, you know, like, roly-poly busy the way a bee is. You know, I'm always, like, going from one thing to another thing, collecting this thing, and, like, taking it back home, and, you know, organizing it and stuff like that. So that's kind of just more, like, it's, and I am sort of noisy.
You're going to say, and Dirty the Hoodie Dance as well.
Maybe. Yeah, I do. Yeah. Like, food does make me dance. So, like, I get very excited, including in restaurants, to my partner's charm and embarrassment when, like, the food comes to the table. I'm always like, yeah, it's so exciting. Look at how cool it is. Like, look at the food.
I get excited by aeroplane food. It's just, the whole experience is delightful.
Yeah. I mean, anytime somebody, like, another person brings me food, it is reason to embrace life, as far as I'm concerned.
Exactly. Added to the fact you don't have to do the washing and cleaning up afterwards, just I miss those days.
Where are you, a honeybee or sparkles?
Honeybee, because there's nothing sparkly about my personality. People tell me I'm positive and enthusiastic. I don't believe them. I think I'm more, you know, cynical and abrasive, but that might just be me. So I like the idea of honeybee because I could sting you.
Ooh. I'm going to go with sparkles because I feel like I am sparkly, even if it's for pretend. I think I can pretend sparkle very well. So I'm going to be sparkles.
Nice. Okay, next question. Would you rather solely communicate through homemade Valentine cards or strategically applied eyelash fluttering?
Love this question.
Valentine's cards, definitely. Because it's written, so, and crafty and stuff. I used to homemade Valentine's cards all the time. It's like, I don't know, but I like sort of two-dimensional art forms that are also something that you can give to other people. I like useful art. It's a weird quirk, I guess. There's a reason I was a potter for years, and that's because I like to give pottery, because, like, it's a thing that you can also use, right? And so that makes me, it's also why I like to, you know, cook and bake and stuff, because, like, it's like an art form, and I always decorate things really prettily because I like pretty things. So definitely the Valentine's cards.
Same.
Yeah.
I'm big on paper crafts and making. I make my husband a Valentine's card every year, and I've done it since 2009, I think. And they're all, like, they all have a theme. I made a Castlevania card a few years ago. I did Star Wars this year. I have a Gandalf stopping the Balrog. I have too many. But they're pretty great, and he keeps them on display all year until the next one comes
out.
That's
cool.
They are good. You sent me pictures, and they are epic. Like, there's a lot of effort goes into those ones. No, I'm with you.
I like making Valentine cards. Just going to make them.
I like crafting. I'm like a baker more. Like, I will give gifts of cake and biscuits. I love baking. I adore it. I made a pavlova the other day. It was just...
I'm so jealous. Do you have a signature bake? You're kind of known for? No,
not particularly. Like, if you ask my son, he'll say my meatballs. But then he also says I do the best egg fried rice. Like, but then he adores when I make biscuits. Like, I don't know. I used to have a signature bake, which was Halloween biscuits. And it would take hours. It would break my back. I would make gingerbread men and then put the mummy wrappings around them and make them 3D.
Wow.
And vampire biscuits with the jam inside, and so it looked like the blood.
Yeah.
I haven't done those in quite some time, because it is a lot of time to do them. It takes me a couple of days to do them. But I tend to make the birthday cakes every year. Like, I made a volcano dinosaur cake with, like, the chocolate, white chocolate ganache I dyed green, poured it over, and then a Malteser volcano with the ganache coming out, so it looked like it was pouring. They are not, like, sculpturally, they will never go on Great British Bake Off. They will never be there. they look homemade in the highest definition of homemade, but they always taste nice. I don't make a bad bake.
That's important.
That's very important.
That is important.
And I've recently gotten into pavlovas, making my own meringues. The Nigella Lawson one is my favorite because it's the gooey on the inside.
That I like the key to a pavlova is it has to have, the meringue has to cover all three textures. So it has to be soft and fluffy and gooey and crispy on the edges. Like that's why you do a pavlova, a big pavlova, and not little individual ones, right? Yeah. And I am known for this being my favorite dessert, and yet I live in Northern California where you cannot get pavlovas. It's just not a thing here. Like, you just can't. They're just not. They don't really exist. I mean, you can occasionally find them in a restaurant or something. And so my partner was like, I'm going to make you one for your birthday last year, I think this was. And so they went to all this effort to like find these Mary Berry's recipe and did not like change proportions at all. And the resulting pavlova was about the size of our stovetop.
Yes.
It was like a large-sized pizza. And it was huge. That was the meringue size. You know, like the whole pavlova.
Yes.
And I had to eat the whole thing.
Oh, a never last slog in my house, ever. I have to use... If I know I'm gonna have, my son's going to have it, he doesn't like cream, so I have to use yogurt. He loves yogurt, so instead of cream, and because the cream, the yogurt's like a wetter, it goes into the pavlova soon, so you have to eat it quicker. But if it's cream, it lasts a few days. But we went fruit picking at a local farm and just had this great big pile of fresh fruit, and I needed to do something with it, so I decided to pavlova. If the one I eat, I have to make half the recipe, and it still turns out. The size
enormous.
The
yeah, that's what
it
like
massive.
I was gonna get another one this year, and I was basically like, look, there really is only the two of us, and I have to eat most of this thing, so can you make half? But we ended up not bothering,
because
I was like, that's just
still
so
huge.
Much sugar. It's so sweet and it's so much sugar.
I did half last, I'd never made one until last year, and I had two different recipes. One of them may have been Mary Berry, the other one was Nigella Lawson. I tried them both, and the Nigella was much fluffy, like marshmallowy kind of texture on the inside. And I only did half, thinking, okay, I'll do a full one for Christmas Day when my in-laws come round. And I still just maintained and did half because it's just so big. My oven is not big enough. It's not just that you need an industrial size oven for this thing.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's absolutely wicked big. But yes, I have promised if I ever meet physically Amanda, I will make her a pavlova because she'd never heard of
good. Them. Good. They're so good. I did grow up with them because they're weirdly popular in the corner of Devon, which is near Exeter, that I spent like my childhood with my grandparents on, you know, in summer times and stuff.
Yeah.
And specifically there in Devon, it tends to be a raspberry pavlova, at least in the parts that I was. And it tends to be, with clotted cream, because you're in Devonshire, right? And that is like the pavlova that I think of as my childhood thing. And oh my God, they're so good.
You can get this banoffee one from a local shop, and oh my gosh.
Oh no.
But they are small, they're just like individual pavlovas, but they're still huge, where you could happily share them. And it's a banoffee, and it's like as tall as. It's like it's
a pint glass.
Just thinking about it. It's easily, easily. Oh gosh!
I have a wish. I have a pavlova wish list, and on that wish list is a passion fruit glazed pavlova, which I know you can probably get down under. And someday I will eat this thing because passion fruit is my favorite fruit, and pavlova is my favorite dessert. And so someday before I die, I will find and eat. That's it. That's my life goal. Yeah, probably.
We need to cover a different
life goal.
A different Parasol Verse series, and I will make for the cover picture a passion fruit pavlova. I will eat it afterwards, but it will be pictured.
We got sidetracked. This would you rather got into food, and then
we
all
did,
bets are
right?
off.
It's food. It's food.
Would you rather kill off a tyrannical mastermind, overthrow a secret society, or stop a pudding war?
It depends, I suppose. Yeah, this is serious. It depends on the ramifications of a pudding war, because if a pudding war results in like some sort of lack of pudding or custard or egg, then that is a serious business that must be ended as quickly as possible.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Because, you know, those things are sacred and should get, you know, supply lines must not be affected. So under the theory that a pudding war involves some sort of like damage to trade in terms of custard distribution, then I'm probably going to go with the pudding war.
I think given the conversation about Pavlova, I'm all over with you there. We cannot stop the cream supply.
No.
No.
I want to stop a tyrannical mastermind.
Yeah, the thing is, a mastermind is, you know, like, dangerous and overt. And the secret society, like, you know, one of the tenets of my universe is that, like, true power is in people who are manipulating in the background. And so, like, if a secret society is, like, morally or ethically bankrupt and is against your, like, general tactics to thrive, then probably the secret society is the greatest risk.
I kind of like the idea of the secret society being overthrown and nobody would know about it either.
Exactly.
And it's kind of like,
yeah, exactly.
I just delight like that. In it.
But see, then I also want to be a part of the secret society.
But it's a very,
so could I take it down from the inside?
You could be part of the secret society that overthrows the tyrannical secret society.
It's a very triumvirate thing, right? Because like the pudding war, so we have pudding war, secret society, and mastermind. So like Alexia is going after a mastermind, Sophronia is going after a secret society, and Prudence is stopping a pudding war. It's like kind of like the three different series is in one question, right? Like, so like whose personality do you tend to associate with the most if you're like going up against these things? Because it's going to require a different kind of personality to, like, if you need to be brash and forward and out there and like crazy and take risks and stop this pudding war, then like that's your Prudence, right? If you need to be like practical and like strategic in your approach, and then you know that's Alexia, and it's good. And if you need to be secretive, then it's going to be Sophronia. So
what if it was a tyrannical mastermind of a secret society trying to stop pudding trade?
Well, it would take all three of them, wouldn't it?
The ultimate of evils.
Exactly.
Anywho. You. Next question.
What if it was like, wait, what if it was like a sexy pudding fight? And everyone is like,
you had to go,
you know, you're
there.
In like
you
the
had
jello.
To go there with the chocolate mousse pudding being thrown around and
yeah.
Oh, suddenly we're in like when we jumped ship to the San Andreas universe.
Yeah. Let's visit San Andreas for a while.
And or
now we're talking to GL
yeah,
characters.
Yeah, got a reality TV show going on in the background that is like, I don't know.
I don't think I would stop that pudding war.
Merman pudding wrestling or something like that.
Now on pay-per-view.
Exactly.
I'm more likely to try and market it than I am to stop it.
Yeah. I would be in the front row, like, trying to get
you
in.
You could be the girl who, like, or the big, you know, the person who goes around.
Oh, I could hold up the cards.
Yeah, round one, round two. Now it's mint chocolate. Right.
Okay.
Now we have added caramel.
Yes.
This, and there'll be the custard round.
But what do I wear while I'm doing that?
An apron. It's pudding. You need, you know, Cannell's leather apron.
I would wear Cannell's leather apron. I would wear the hell out of Cannell's leather apron.
No, you would wear the hell out of Cannell in the leather apron.
This is probably true. Yes. Okay, now that
thank you
that has happened, what is what's our last question?
Would you rather go goth with all the black velvet, poetry and melancholy, or run around in a nightdress through the woods being overly dramatic and lovesick? I love this question.
Running around through the woods in a nightdress. We've already discussed wafting already, so like I feel like I have a leg up in the wafting arena. Yeah, and I already have future plans, which I have, you know, talked about on multiple occasions, to become a permanent resident of cruise ships and wear white trailing dresses and waft about and never talk to anybody or say anything, just like leave my room at say midnight and waft around the decks in a vintage, you know, huge straw hat and white trailing dress, and then just like, go back to my room so people will just constantly be like, who is that woman who lives in 406A. That's my retirement plan. So clearly wafting is in my future.
Wafting. Yeah, definitely.
That's a great plan. I like it.
I've just got these images suddenly just turning up at the shuttleboard, do one little push of the thing, yeah, and then waft
turn
away.
And walk away. Yeah, exactly.
Well, they have those midnight buffets on cruise ships, don't they? And you just walk past and, you know, eye them up and then just walk away, and everybody's like, is the cruise ship haunted?
Yeah, exactly. Or you show up and you only ever eat like one thing.
Yes. Yes, you know, it's like the midnight chocolate one. Just one truffle.
Yeah, just one, and then walk away.
Yes. Of course, you will have a plate sent to the room.
Of course, yes. But only be seen ever to like eat one thing, or maybe just not even eat, like maybe just take a bit of the decoration off the buffet. Just be like, that bird of paradise flower is mine. Just walk away.
Oh no, you see, I went on a cruise when I was 18, and I feel like I've missed a trick here. I didn't waft at all.
Sad.
You've clearly missed out. We should all go on a cruise together and
see
waft.
The problem is I do get seasickness. Like, I have to just sit on deck. So as long as I've got an open window during the day and I can emerge on a night, I'll be fine. I need the fur.
What if you're constantly wafting? Do you think would you get used to it? Because you're already like rocking and wafting. Would it balance out?
No, I did try. I spent my entire time above deck because it's the only way to negate the sick feeling, which was hilarious because the entire time beforehand, me and my brother were like, oh, we'll just sit at the dining room table and just back and forth and make other people sick. And I was the one who succumbed to, it wasn't like massive, but if it was a queasiness, I didn't particularly appreciate. It was a good trip though. I went to Pompeii and everything. It was great.
I've never been on a cruise. Fun. I mean, I've done a lot of boat stuff, but, you know, like little cruises around cities and, you know, up and down rivers and that sort of thing. But I've never been on like an official big cruise thing.
Oh, mine was an Italian cruise. So I went to Rome, Naples. And while we're in Naples, went to Pompeii. It was just all down the Italian coast. And Sicily was beautiful. And, what did I sing in the amphitheatre? I Will Survive. The amphitheater in Sicily. I can't sing. And Italy knows this.
That is very nice. I've been on a couple of cruises to the Bahamas, but now that we live in Seattle, I want to go to Alaska because it's right here.
I would love to go on an Alaskan cruise. They look amazing. I don't know how much wafting can take place in an Alaskan cruise because it looks a bit chilly.
I think you can layer for wafting. I've been watching a Chinese drama called Eternal Love, which is fabulous and involves a lot of robes, like diaphanous layers of diaphanous robes, one pale color on top of another pale color, with very trailing sleeves, but you're like completely covered. There's like very little skin showing, and you could have lots of warm things and still waft. You just layer your wafting abilities, and you know, and they do a lot of like wafting through peach forests in full bloom, and like Ooh. You know, casting themselves on symbolic rocks,
like going behind you, don't you?
I've spent far too much time in this universe because it's a very, as is common with Chinese series dramas, extremely long, and nothing happens, really. And what does happen is extremely confusing because everybody has like 8 different names and it's all like steeped in mythology. But I can just watch it for the wafting. The wafting is enough for me.
With a notepad, making tips and hints. I need to do that.
Yes, exactly.
Yes, you can employ like full kimono, couldn't you? Like sort of like.
Yeah, it's okay. Quite warm. Yeah.
Let's Alaskan cruise waft.
Okay. All right. Let's add it to our list of things that we're going to do if we ever meet in person. Wafting.
Which are you wafting through the woods as well?
Oh, of course.
We all chose to waft.
Of course.
No, I'm going to go golf.
Oh, really?
What?
I know I enjoy a waft. I'm keeping up for the butterfly. But there's just something amazing about donning the old velvet, going completely goth.
I have to say, I have spent,
melancholy.
I've spent my whole life wishing I could be a goth, like, but I just don't have the, I don't have the chutzpah to carry it off, I don't think. Like, I just don't have it. I don't have it in me. So there, I do understand the temptation to go goth. I just think I would be very, very bad at it. For one thing, I'm chipper and smile all the time. So I get excited about things like food. Yeah. So, or wafting, and like, I think a tenet of, you know, the goth is attitude, and I don't have it. Mm-hmm. Don't have the right attitude.
Not the goth fashion.
You can't be a wafting goth.
Well, oh, so my friend,
application of lace, you could.
So my friends and I used to have a saying back in the 90s when, you know, goth and grunge and everything was sort of endemic to the world. I mean, still around, but it was a big deal back then, where there was what we called the pink of goth, which is when you've gone all the way through goth to the other side and emerged into sort of gothic Lolita or whatever, which, you know, kind of is influenced by raver culture and like that kind of aesthetic, and has now become anime. And like the anime thing, but we called it the pink of goth. So there is the other side of goth, but I still think that also requires a certain attitude that I just don't personally have. But I always wanted to do it, or at least try it for a while.
Yeah, I think I will be one of those goths who you see on the adverts, and you know, when they take the mick out of things, and it's the goth on the beach with the ice cream. Mm-hmm. Or on the roller coaster, and you're just like,
one of my favorite blogs on Tumblr was for years was Goths in Hot Weather.
Yes,
just pictures of that. It's great.
Yes, I think great. I will be goth in hot weather.
Yeah,
just, goth lends itself to the steampunk aesthetic a little bit easily, and it's a dream. It's a dream.
Yeah, the closest
I went through.
Sorry, go on.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say,
I went through a really big emo phase in college. Wow. So I think like that was as close as I'm ever going to get to goth. Yeah.
I did cyberpunk, which is as close as I ever got. Like I had a big, so when everyone else was doing grunge, I was like, this is not for me. So I went to mod, which was also pretty popular in like the early 90s, and threw mod into cyberpunk. And those were my cyberpunk days. And that I like that aesthetic a lot and kind of miss it, but.
I didn't go through an emo phase, and I'm kind of glad, because emo was a bad thing when I was growing up. If you were emo, oh no, you frowned upon the emo.
Wasn't goth as well?
No, goth was more accepted. Goth was much more everybody. Yeah, if you want, locally, goth was better than emo. Emo was the lowest on the pecking order. I don't know. I just kind of like, when I got to college, when I was 16, and at college in the UK, and then university, I was far too busy actually studying to do anything. I didn't go to university parties or anything like that. I was boring. I was studying. And at college, that's kind of when I came out of my shell a little bit and actually started getting friends and going out. And it was just kind of like, well, actually, that was my developing a personality phase and finding out who I was, not trying to get into a niche area, because I had a spectrum of friends. So I didn't feel like I needed to be in any particular area. And this sounds ridiculous, but I found jeans. I'd never owned a pair of jeans until like 17, 18, 19. I just found jeans, and that was my phase, was jeans. And that sounds really pathetic, but yeah, that was me, because I never did the emo thing or anything like that. Boots.
I think I really just did it for the excuse to wear eyeliner, a lot of it. I still wear too much eyeliner. But not as much as I did in college.
You learned how to put eyeliner on the past few years. I could never put eyeliner on until about 5 years ago.
It was high school for me. It was definitely like, college was when I was more experimental and just sort of like did crazy stuff with my look and whatever I felt like it and stuff. But high school was when I was like doing crazy, crazy colors in my hair and definitely doing the like cyber thing and, you know, like insane pigtail kind of looks and stuff. And I drove this like old beat, like really beat up pickup truck, and it didn't have nothing. It was the most basic car in the universe. It didn't have power steering or power brakes or anything, you know, so like I could kind of repair it and and I had to constantly be doing stuff to it because it was always falling apart. And we had a boom, like a little baby boom box, my best friend and I, like, and the boom box was with tape, a tape deck boom box that we would play music in, and it was terrible. And so we had to play the music really, really loud to be able to hear it over the sound of my beat up pickup truck, which made a ton of noise anyway. And so we would drive around in this beat up pickup way too fast. I was a terrible speed demon driver. I'm still not great about that sort of thing. Blasting really bad kind of, you know, 90s music. And that was just what we did. Like, that was just how we lived. And like, this was before seatbelt laws. So like, I would just pile all of my friends in the back of this pickup truck and like, you know, just go cause a ruckus places. And we were told, said best friend and I, years later, that her younger brother's age group thought of us as the bad girls. And you could not have found two people more excited in your life to have realized that they had a reputation for being bad girls in high school, because we were both total nerds. She's a mathematician. and I was a geeky sci-fi reading, obsessed with history kid.
Hey, it's history and science and math. That's hot. STEM, yeah,
apparently,
is hot.
It's also the bad girls. That's great.
That's crazy.
Yeah. I'm curious as to what was in your tape deck.
Oh my God.
Did you ruin any cassette tapes? Because you played them too much?
This was the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s. There's a lot of like mixtapes where you like recorded stuff off the radio. So mm-hmm. like the back and mm-hmm. front ends are missing. And I also got into like soundtracks for a long time. So I had a lot of movie soundtrack mixtapes and stuff.
That's nice. My preferred music choice because I'm terrible with music. I'll stick a soundtrack
me too.
On.
Yeah.
To this day, I have terrible taste.
I don't know anything about music.
I've never been an audiophile. Like, I didn't go to, I'm not a concert person. I don't like gatherings of large people, large numbers of people, period. So, like, conventions are like, do I have to? Oh, fine. And I'll have fun once I'm there. But concert, I was like, I don't like any bands really enough to, you know, but I liked, I love rockabilly and I got really into, you know, like punk covers and stuff. So like, I'm a huge mm-hmm. Me First and the Gimme Gimmes fan, but that was sort of after high school, that they weren't really around mm-hmm. high school. So like, I, you know, there's a lot of early punk and stuff like that that I was mm-hmm. playing. Yeah.
Miss the days of mixtapes where you missed off half the songs. I do miss those days. No, it's just playlists. I do have one playlist called Unrepentant. It's got some dodgy.
And you had to kind of remember which songs were on which mixtape, and you'd just be like, I want to listen to that one, but I have to listen to the whole thing to get to it.
You have to forward, wind, rewind, and you had to make sure that you perfectly had tiny little handwriting on the card. And then you would no doubt put the songs in the wrong order. But, oh, God.
Yes! Yes, yes, exactly.
And then if the tape came undone, you had to get a pencil and wind it back
in. Yeah, wind it up.
Make sure there was no creases. Mm-hmm.
That's the end of Would You Rather.
Okay.
Let's end right there. Right there in that really awkward spot. Thank you for joining us for Would You Rather.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Thank you.
Bye, ladies. Okay. I'll talk
Bye.
To you next time.
So perfect in every way.
Oh, that was so much fun.
I love it. I love all the wafting.
So much wafting. We need to go on that Alaskan cruise and waft.
Yes, we really, really do. It needs to happen. If Miss Gale doesn't retire to a cruise ship, I mean, there's something wrong with the world.
Or at least take an extended cruise just to waft.
Yeah. Or maybe she can like take on a position as like cruise ship librarian or something, because those positions actually exist. And she would be delightful in that role. And then, you know, she could enjoy some books in the cruise ship and waft and sneakily steal. What is she talking about stealing? Oh my God. Just secretly stealing things and wafting back off to her room.
Just that single truffle or that bird of paradise flower. Oh, look, a potted plant. It's mine now. Thank you.
So great. So great. Everything about it. Everything about Miss Gale is just...
delightful, there's just no words. And wonderful, yes. And amazing. Yes. And
she's been on the show so many times, and she just keeps coming back.
Yeah.
And yeah. I'm so happy that she does.
Yeah. She's crazy. But, you know they say never meet your heroes? And this is twice for me, and both times I've, like, she's made me cry, and it's been amazing, and I've loved it, and I'm yeah. just so happy that she is just so wonderful. She's wonderful to us, she's wonderful to all of her fans, and she's just,
she really
she's
is.
Just an amazing person. So
she really is. She really is. Okay. So,
breathe.
Favorite breathe. Final breathe. Thought quote. What is your favorite final thought quote this time?
As justice would have it, we should all be so lucky as to go wafting about dramatically in a trailing nightgown on occasion.
Wafting. More wafting. Wafting.
Which is hugely appropriate. I picked this before we yes. did Would You Rather, and it's hugely appropriate for our Would You Rather discussion as well.
Yes. Yes.
What about you?
Espionage is merely an excuse for advanced accessorizing tactics.
Love it. Love it.
So
love it.
True. So true.
Beyond true. I love it. I love yes. it. I love it.
Yes. So true.
I'm just basking in the glory of Would You Rather at
I
the
know.
Moment.
I know. I don't have time for anything else. Can we just be done?
No. We need to give our fair listeners their recommendations.
Yes.
And the first one I'm going to pass to you.
Ah, yes. Thank you. I will gladly take this one from you. The first one is called The Sweetness at the Bottom of the Pie by Alan Bradley.
Which is a wonderful title.
Yes. This is a delightful series featuring the main character Flavia Deluce. Summary from Goodreads. It's the summer of 1950, and at the once grand mansion of Buckshaw, young Flavia Deluce, an aspiring chemist with a passion for poison, is intrigued by a series of inexplicable events. A dead bird is found on the doorstep, a postage stamp bizarrely pinned to its beak. Then, hours later, Flavia finds a man lying in the cucumber patch and watches him as he takes his dying breath. For Flavia, who is both appalled and delighted, life begins in earnest when murder comes to Buckshaw. I wish I could say I was afraid, but I wasn't. Quite the contrary. This was by far the most interesting thing that had ever happened to me in my entire life. Such a good series.
That
so
sounds
good.
Like
and
it would link in nicely with the Truly Devious series as well.
Yes, and also with Finishing School, because I believe Flavia is 11.
Oh.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
That is young.
She's an old 11, what with her chemistry and poisons and murder. But yes. Very good. It's a very good series.
It sounds
highly
really
recommend
good.
It.
It sounds really, really good. The next recommendation is not necessarily because it fits with the Finishing School or the Three Deadlies. It's more that the author, Charlie N. Homburg, is often recommended hand in hand with Gail Carriger.
Yes.
So I picked out The Paper Magician, which is number one in the series of the same name, because it sounds brilliant and I really fancy picking this one up as well. Okay, so the summary has... from Goodreads, Sione Twill arrives at the cottage of magician Emery Thane with a broken heart. Having graduated at the top of her class from the Tagus Praff School for the Magically Inclined, Sione is assigned an apprenticeship in paper magic despite her dreams of bespelling metal. And once she's bonded to paper, that will be her only magic forever. Yet the spells Sione learns under this strange yet kind Thane turn out to be more marvellous than she could have ever imagined. Animating paper creatures, bringing stories to life via ghostly images, even reading fortunes. But as she discovers these wonders, Sione also learns of an extraordinary danger of forbidden magic. An excisioner, a practitioner of dark flesh magic, invades the cottage and rips Thane's heart from his chest. To save her teacher's life, Sione must face the evil magician and embark on an unbelievable adventure that will take her into the chambers of the still beating heart and reveal the very soul of the man. And I think that book sounds absolutely flippin' amazing, and I am gonna read it.
That sounds fantastic. You know, I don't know if anyone else gets Miss Gale's chirrups, which if you don't, you should sign up for the chirrup. That's her newsletter that she sends out through email. You should sign up for the chirrup because in the most recent one, she mentions an Instagram photo contest that she is running with Charlie and Holmberg. You should participate by liking their Instagrams. Check out their Instagram accounts. And you can win this Instagram challenge by following them and posting a pretty picture of either of their books, together or not, and tag it hashtag GaleTangoCharlie. This contest is open until August 1st, so you guys should do that. So that's it for this episode of Fictional Hangover, but don't forget about the bonus episodes. Very fantastic. I'm Amanda.
And I'm Claire.
Join us next time as we discuss Warm Bodies by Isaac Marion, narrated by Kevin Kennerly. Contact us if you'd like to join us for an upcoming Would You Rather segment or if you have any books to recommend. Look out for the next Would You Rather poll on social media. Don't forget about our book club and monthly challenges on Facebook, and be sure to visit our brand new shop on Redbubble. That's fictionalhangove.redbubble.com. Fictionalhangove, no E-R. .redbubble.com to find all your favorite Fictional Hangover themed merchandise. Until next time, remember, the only cure for a fictional hangover is another book. Oh, are we done? Are we done now?
Do the bustle hustle. You can find us at fictionalhangover.com, follow us on Instagram at fictionalhangover, find us on Facebook at facebook.com/fictionalhangover, and on Twitter at fictionalhangover, no ER. If you'd like this episode, check out our others and rate, review and subscribe so you don't miss out. And finally, special thanks to Liz Emerson for our music. You can find her on Facebook and Patreon. Thanks for listening.